Hi, everyone. This is the Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. I'm your host, Guy Frankel. Today, we'll be speaking to Noga Tarnopolsky. She's an independent journalist who has extensively covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the U.S. in the Middle East, and human rights in South America. She's reported from Argentina, Mexico, Jordan, Uzbekistan, Poland, Turkey, and France. Her work has been published in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Haaretz, and numerous other newspapers as well. And she's also been on CNN. Is that correct, Noga?
Yes.
And an interesting tidbit about you, you also were once a food and wine columnist.
I have great news to share with you, which is that that needs some updating, because I'm now newly, again, a wine columnist for Haaretz.
For Haaretz. Okay, so you're also reporting from Haaretz. Wonderful. Okay.
I report on wine, right.
Which on is wine, okay.
Subject.
Wonderful. Okay, so thank you, Noga, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So I just wanted to jump right in and talk about the elections. What did you think of the results? Did you expect them? I personally was obviously a bit shocked on Tuesday morning, and I was incredibly disappointed. But it seems like everyone got everything wrong.
You're referring to Wednesday morning, right?
Excuse me, to Wednesday morning.
Yeah. Look, I think we're more or less in the same boat. I have to confess to you that on Tuesday, I published an op-ed in Reuters, which anyone can look at.
I saw that, and the title was very sort of like, was it like Bye Bye Bibi, correct?
Yeah, the title was Bye Bye Bibi, and it was basically my analysis, which I'd been pushing fairly hard, about why Netanyahu was most likely to lose, why he was a very vulnerable candidate. And I feel, you know, I have a complex set of feelings because, of course, I got it wrong. On the other hand, what's interesting is that actually I got it wrong in terms of the results. I definitely didn't expect that the Likud would sweep past Labor or the Zionist Union. On the other hand, all my actual points of logic turned out to be correct, and so we see a combination right now in the electoral results, which on the one hand is very, very disheartening, I would say, for everybody on the center and on the left, in which Netanyahu seems set right now to establish a really kind of hardcore right-wing government. And I certainly didn't expect that, and many others didn't expect that. On the other hand, we have to be honest and say, you know, the left actually made gains. The parties, the principal parties that really lost seats in this Israeli election are, surprisingly, the religious parties, the traditional religious parties, Shas, Yadut HaTorah, these parties really lost. So, you know, I think it's a mixed bag, and I think that we need some cool heads to be able to really study it well.
Well, why do you think that pollsters got things so wrong? I'm reminded of that that quote that Shimon Peres made a few years ago when he said that polls are like perfume. They're lovely to smell, but they're poison to drink. And I think before election day, I got the impression that people were sort of swept up in this sort of euphoria on the center and the left, and they really thought that, you know, change was at hand. And personally, I was a little bit more skeptical. I didn't think that there would be such a major upset. But why did pollsters predict this incredibly terrible?
I'm not a pollster, and I don't know. There have been a lot of explanations. There's one pollster who got it right, and he's quite a controversial figure. It's Professor Avi Dagani from Geocartography Institute.
Right, and that was the outlying poll, I believe.
That was extremely outlying poll, and it was dismissed by many people, among them my beloved colleague Al Schneider and myself, because he has worked for the Likud in the past, and because in the 2013 election, he's the one who foresaw that the Likud and Lieberman together would get up to 40 Knessets, which never happened. So, to answer your question, what Avi Dagani, who got it right this time, said is that the other principal pollsters in Israel relied on internet-based polling groups, and that the internet finally does not represent Israelis, that it skews urban, it skews young, it skews non-Haredi and non-Arab, and that's why he claims they got it wrong from the beginning. The fact that he got it right now using his techniques and got it really wrong 2 years ago maybe should lead us to think that polls simply shouldn't be given that much weight, which I think is something that needs to be discussed in the political arena. And Shelly Yachimovich has made this poll, she's made, this point very, very forcefully since Labour's, you know, on the one hand gains, but on the other hand disappointing results. She's really hit hard on the reliance on polls. What the pollsters who failed, principally, you know, the famous Manu Geva and Mina Tzemach and Camille Fuchs, what they're saying is that people, to a great extent, lied to them, that they were deceived, that people, especially in locations where the Likud votes heavily, I'm talking about the exit polls, that there appeared to be a very, very, very low voter participation, and in fact, just the people didn't, you know, they didn't respond to the pollsters' questions, or if they did, they did so fraudulently. So, I don't know, but it was a screw-up.
I mean, I was on Twitter when that outlier, quote-unquote outlier poll was released, and I remember there was a lot of, actually, there was a lot of derision. Like, people were literally, they were, I think, laughing at it, because it seemed so bizarre. And in retrospect, I guess the joke was all on us.
I don't know. You know, I really don't know what to say. And that's why I'm pointing out that this same pollster really got everything very wrong a mere 2 years ago. I think you and I may have actually communicated via Twitter at the time that I-24 News released the poll. But I don't think I was derisive, but I really pressed them very, very hard in an interaction with them about the fact that this poll was so off the charts and that they were using a Likud pollster. You know, and I didn't really get a response from them, but to me it seemed a reason to give that poll less weight. And I don't know, frankly, if he was smarter than everyone and he got it right, or if he was just lucky this time. I just don't know.
Yeah. So I interviewed someone from V15 about a week before the elections, and I remember he told me that they, you know, their goal was not necessarily to galvanize people on the right to vote for them, but to encourage people on the center and the left. I think the attitude was sort of like, well, we know they won't vote for us anyway, so we'll just try to get as many people in the center and the left to vote for center, you know, center left and left wing.
The lefty version of, what's his name, Mitt Romney, is, I know there's 47% that's never going to vote for me.
Right.
Yeah,
which was clearly a mistake. So obviously it's a mistake to sort of dismiss obviously a large chunk of the country. But what does, and this is obviously a question I think we could talk about for weeks, for years actually. What does the left really need to do to get the right to vote? You know, to not vote for Bibi.
Well, look, you're right. This is a question we could talk about for months, and it's also a question that maybe we should talk about for months. I feel a great rejection. The standard Israeli defeatist left-wing vibe, which is Bibi's unbeatable, he's a magician, you know,
right.
Parliamentary process, he can always put together. There was a big attitude, which I really feel, I have to say, almost disdain for on the left, which is kind of, well, let's just sit down on our butts in the cafes because there's nothing we can do against this Superman machine of the right, Bibi, anyway.
Right.
And I think, and that's one of the reasons why I've been a little prickly since these results, because I actually think that, you know, the last three elections are elections in which Bibi Netanyahu was voted into power legally, right, properly, every single time. And on the other hand, these are all elections in which his fundamental weakness as a candidate is revealed, and what is simultaneously revealed is the failure of the left wing to step in forcefully and assertively into that space and kind of claim their own political legitimacy.
Correct.
So in 2009, he actually lost to Tzipi Livni. In 2013, he got into power as a result of two alliances, one with Lieberman, who at that time, you know, was still seen almost as a like a right-wing heir, kind of the way Bennett was seen now just 2 years later.
Right.
And then he made his, you know, in 2009 he had a secret deal with Chess. He's an epic deal maker. In this election, I actually think that the guy was a very weak candidate. I think that his resorting to an openly racist call on election day, I think his kind of desperate repair to the media after not being interviewed by Israeli media for 13 months while being a sitting prime minister and then a candidate again to be prime minister, his repair to the Israeli media in the last 3 days in which he thought he might lose, his absolute repudiation of what has been the official position of the State of Israel vis-a-vis the two-state solution, I think all of these desperate and unseemly acts show that he actually is not a beloved leader and that he is a weak candidate. And I think, I don't know what to tell you about V15, because I think, you know, in any open society, any organization has the right to express its opinion. My critique is not against them at all. I think they have the right to do whatever they want. But I have a very, very strong critique against merits, definitely, and the Labour Party also to a significant extent, about not reaching out to the public who at least should have been given the chance to be exposed to them. And I think it's a real problem.
Do you think that the left has... this is my personal opinion again. Do you think that one of the major problems of the left is that they haven't fielded a really strong alternative to someone like Netanyahu, someone really with like the stature of Rabin, or even like Olmert, for example? I mean, I sort of feel like, and I don't think I'm the only one who feels this way, that if Olmert had been allowed to run, that he would have really stood a chance against Bibi.
I don't know. I can't speculate that far. But I kind of have the limitations of being a journalist, so I can deal with whoever was running this time, but not whoever didn't run.
Of course.
But I think, look, I actually have to say, I'll say it's not very popular to say right now, I don't think Herzog was a bad candidate, and I don't think Herzog ran a bad campaign. I think Herzog, and I think the Labour Party fielded an excellent slate of candidates, very appealing on many levels. I think their campaign was lacking, and I think mostly, I think they ran a good but limited campaign. Since they ran an effective campaign, they gained seats, they gained stature, but they didn't even bother to present themselves to people who needed not just to hear from them, but to hear from them again and again. You know, the prime minister has basically dominated Israeli politics for close to 2 decades. He's been, apart from the few years, I think around 5 years at Sharon, was a very, you know, controversial and changeable prime minister. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu is without doubt the dominant political figure in Israel in the last generation. There's an entire voting public that simply doesn't know any other figure as prime minister really than him. You know, everyone who's basically 25 and under, you say prime minister and the face of Netanyahu comes into their mind. So the left wing had to do a real job. They had to invest the last year in presenting themselves as a viable alternative, in not wasting time, in being in every single, you know, there should have been a permanent presence in southern Israel of Labour candidates fighting for those causes. And Labour, I think, has very appealing candidates, and including candidates whose kind of demographic representation has been dismissed. People like, you know, Amir Peretz, who is not only of Moroccan ethnicity, but who's a former mayor of Sderot. He was not taken advantage of at all in this campaign. He wasn't fielded in the way he should have been. Yossi Yona, who is, you know, a professor these days, but who grew up without even shoes, the child of Iraqi immigrants, I think the eighth child or something, and who's, you know, a highly accomplished, highly eloquent person. He ended up being trapped by the Likud personification of him as a kind of anti-Zionist radical rebel. And they either didn't invest enough or they didn't ever manage to pull him out of that rubric and use him as a voice for people who feel dismissed in Israeli society. Zoher Bahlul is another candidate. I can't imagine a more beloved figure in the Israeli journalistic realm. He's number 17 on Labor, very much so, and his voice was barely heard in this campaign, and he's a hugely attractive, intelligent, wise candidate. So, I mean, I could go on and on. I don't think they ran a bad campaign, but I think they missed a lot. And I also think that Netanyahu is ruthless. And when he decided to go, full out racist, full out defiant, even in ways that are likely, in my opinion, to really harm the state of Israel in order to win, Labor had no response.
I wanted to retort about some of the candidates because in Meretz, for example, you have Uri Zaki, he didn't make it into the Knesset, and even based on the polls, I don't think he would have. But he's Egyptian, because he's part of Meretz, automatically he's seen as he's not really Egyptian. You know what I mean? There's this sort of image like, well, he's not really Mizrahi, because he's part of Meretz, and people have created this image of what it means to be Mizrahi and what it means to vote for Meretz and what it means to I think he was a victim of that. He's one example.
But it's interesting for me to hear you say something like that because we're talking about. I don't actually know him. I don't know him as a candidate. I know Meretz well enough in the last few years, and I. As you may have seen from some of my writing, I'm one of the people who is profoundly exasperated by Meretz lately. I don't know him. However, I can tell you that just your reaction to him, as pointing to him as a victim of a stereotype against Mizrahim, sounds wrong to me. If you are a candidate for political office, it is absolutely your responsibility to burst out and represent yourself, okay? He may be a victim in other respects in his life. Again, I don't know him. But somebody who is a political candidate for high office, who fails in getting his fundamental essence across, is not, in my mind, a victim, but is somebody who didn't do the right thing. I mean, Meretz is a very problematic entity. And so without knowing anything, I would have to tell you that if we're talking about Meretz, one of my fundamental questions would be, how did the party address his potential as a candidate? Even if he wasn't going to get into the Knesset, how did they exploit or not his potential as an appealing candidate to represent them? Meretz has had, in my opinion, a real, real, real problem in this respect. But I just can't see someone in that position as a victim, the way you're describing. The victims of Sephardic stereotypes are the people in the state of Israel to this day. There are not many, but there are a few who feel that because their name is Bouzaglo, they can't get a job, or they're dismissed, or their opinions are dismissed, or they can't get their kids into the best school in Ashdod, or the kibbutzniks ignore their wife's health needs and send them to the clinic outside of the yeshuv. I mean, they're real problems, and they're certainly terrible and very real feeling of being put down, even today, by a certain cut of the Mizrahi, specifically the Moroccan population in Israel. But if you're a candidate for Meretz, I really think you've got to be able to get your story out there. There's been a really interesting public discussion in Israel since the elections, because the word that's been chosen by Israeli journalists to talk about this vote is, quote-unquote, a tribal vote, which I consider really an unfortunate choice of words. It's kind of borrowed from sociology, I think. And it makes people sound to be idiots, like that they vote just because, daddy and grandpa voted. And the Israeli media has been very successful in getting, in particular, for example, workers from Israel, the Israeli chemical conglomerate that's the biggest employer in the south, that they've been striking, and they had really come out against Netanyahu before the election, and now you have every Israeli journalist finding some Chil worker who says, yeah, I voted Bibi, and they say, why? And they say, oh, my daddy did, and I'm scared of the missiles. And, a lot of stereotypes are built this way. But I think we have to be very careful. For one, the media in Israel uses the term Mizrahi like water. And the writer Eli Amir has come out in the last few days and really, really protested against it, saying he's Iraqi-born, he's Baghdad-educated even, and he doesn't want to be lumped in. And he says what people are really complaining about are those of Moroccan extraction. You have Moroccans saying, you know, that's racist. And they're talking about a quote-unquote fellow Mizrahi. You just mentioned merit candidate of Egyptian extraction. I mentioned before Yossi Yona, a labor candidate who's of Iraqi extraction. These labels are really complicated. The party, in my mind, that has most exploited them really in a terrible way is actually Shas.
Right,
the party
of course.
That purports to represent the Mizrahim, the party that came out with an ad saying, you know, a Sephardic Jew votes for a Sephardic. You know, there's a lot of ethnic stereotyping and a lot of actual racism, none as blatant as the Prime Minister, but I think there's really a lot to work on in the way we understand how people define themselves and in the way they vote.
So I did actually want to jump back into the question about the consolidation of the right's power. I feel as though we touched upon it at the beginning of the discussion, and I think there's a lot of doom and gloom, you know, and even I think the way foreign media reports on it. Oh, the Israeli electorate shifted to the right. They shifted it, a hard right shift, and they're like, well, that's not really true. That's not what we're seeing, you know. And I'm really not trying to be overly optimistic or naive about it, but it just, I think what we're seeing is that we saw how successful the right was in consolidating its power into one block, and the left hasn't been able to do that.
Well, right. There's several things to say. The left is, at this moment in Israel, a smaller block than the right. I think that's just something you have to face. What is left kind of in the playground is the middle. And the Israeli center has been more and more claiming its, you know, central role, for lack of a better term. I think for a long time now, I don't know how long it was, but maybe even 10 years ago, right, when Itzik Mordechai, if I'm not mistaken, established his center party, Mishlekt HaMerkaz. Mm-hmm. And basically, from that point on, there have been more or less successful but constant attempts that went through Hatnuah and through Kadima and through Shinui and through Lapid now. I mean, there have been constant, right, unending attempts to consolidate a center, a kind of consensus party, and that is what's getting stronger in Israel, and that may actually be a ray of light, a non-ideological, strong center that kind of wants what I would call bourgeois values, you know, wants people who want to be able to live a good and decent life, make enough money to get to the end of the month, have safe borders, but who are not messianically committed to any particular ideology. The right wing had a very successful election if you're a backer of the prime minister, but if you're almost everyone else in the right, the election was terrible for the Israeli right wing. Bennett, who saw himself, we have to say it, he saw himself as a possible prime ministerial figure, even in this election, has become, you know, a guy who may be a political non-entity. And a lot of the mythologizing of him was done by the so-called left-wing media, you know, who stereotyped him as a kind of right-wing, pro-settlement, high-tech wunderkind. And he's not that. Then you have Lieberman, who another figure who saw himself until very recently as a possible prime minister, who barely managed to scrape into the Knesset this time. You have Moshe Feiglin, who was kicked out of the Likud as part of Netanyahu's actually consolidating himself. So for a lot of, you know, for a lot of people on the fringes of the right, and for a lot of people who have been perceived as really dangerous to fundamental aspects of the Israeli democracy, this was a very bad election.
And so that's definitely another silver lining.
I think that's a silver lining. I mean, what's unsilver about that lining is that people are pointing out that the prime minister has been re-elected to power basically by usurping the extremism of those guys, right?
Correct.
How did Netanyahu get his final surge? By coming out as an open-faced liar on the international stage and as a racist, and that kind of steals Bennett's thunder. So, you know, it's one of these situations where you have to say, well, that's not good and that's worse, but maybe that's better.
Well, I mean, and I would also say that that he stole quite a few of the votes that should have gone to Eli Yishai's Yachad party were also usurped by Netanyahu. So, I mean, I think we can breathe a sigh of somewhat relief that at least Baruch Marzel won't be sitting in the Knesset.
I'm very relieved that Baruch Marzel won't be in the Knesset. I'm also very relieved that Eli Yishai, who I think is one of the most racist figures to emerge on the Israeli political scene recently, I'm relieved he won't be in the Knesset. And I don't think that it is insignificant that both Moshe Feigen and Baruch Marzel are not going to be in this current Knesset. I think that to a certain extent what we saw was the right wing consolidating around its leader Netanyahu and kind of kicking out of its body politic some of the most extreme fringes.
So even, and these figures are even too extreme for many of the rank and file of Likud.
Well, that's what the vote shows. These guys are out.
Right. So what happens now? Now we have, I think a few minutes before we started to speak, Bibi was given enough mandates to form a government. But I get the impression that he really, as I think is the case before, when he was elected prime minister, he really seems, maybe not desperate, but he seems eager to try to avoid putting together a coalition that's hard right, because he knows that without a fig leaf, the international community, and in particular the United States, it is going to come down very hard on him. So what happens now? Like what happens with the Palestinians, with the PA, at the UN? I mean, there's quite a few avenues the PA could go to, back to the Security Council, the ICC, et cetera, et cetera.
When you say that you seem to think he's looking for a fig leaf, what do you see as a possible fig leaf for him in this current configuration?
I mean, I would argue that to a certain degree, Kulanu is a sort of fig leaf, even though it's not identified as a center-left party. But I read, and this may be incorrect, I recently read in an article by Ben Kaspit in Al-Monitor, that Kulanu sort of said, we'll join, but on the condition that you do not even attempt to try and pass any, blatantly anti-democratic legislation, and if you do, then we'll leave or we'll veto it. I don't know how true that is. You're the journalist, so you probably, your connections are a bit better than mine. But I would say that he wanted to court Lapid. He certainly wanted to court Herzog, so he could co-opt his power and weaken him. And listen, there's nothing better than having someone like Herzog or Livni.
When you say he, you mean Netanyahu?
I mean Netanyahu. Yes.
I don't think Netanyahu wanted to co-opt Herzog. I think he wanted to sound him out for possible government. And I don't think that's co-opting. I think that's how parliamentary democracy works. You know, c'est la vie, man. That's how we vote in this country. You have to create coalition governments. If I'm not mistaken, in my entire lifetime, there has not been in the state of Israel a non-coalition, a one-party government.
No, of course. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that, but I feel that my argument is that I sort of feel like it was in Netanyahu's best interests to have someone like Herzog in his government, because it gives it at least a veneer of respectability.
I think that's one aspect. It makes his life on the international arena easier. And I think there's a much worse aspect, which is that in the history of the State of Israel, national unity governments have basically been governments of stasis. They can't get anything done. They don't even agree about when to have breakfast. So for all of these people, and I may be among them, by the way, for all of the people who think that Netanyahu's primary aim is just not to change anything and to keep being in power, stasis is a very appealing option. And in that respect, a national unity government would, on the one hand, give him breathing space internationally, and on the other hand, give him breathing space locally, in the sense that nothing would ever get done. It's important to point out that even if the Likud and the Zionist Union joined forces, they still would not have enough Knesset seats to form a government. That is how fractured the Israeli polity is. So, I mean, when you're forming a coalition, I don't know about using the word to co-opt.
I think I'm just very cynical about Netanyahu's intentions.
Well, I think we all have to be. I think the American president, Obama, is very, I don't know about cynical, I would say he's skeptical. about Netanyahu's intentions right now. I think we all have to be very skeptical. I think, by the way, that many people who voted for Netanyahu are also skeptical but didn't feel that they were offered, you know, a possible alternative. So when you asked about all these international arenas, I'm not good at foreseeing. I feel like I'm a little bit better at explaining things that have happened or are happening, and I don't like to put myself in the position of prophesying. But that said, I think there are very good chances that Israel will find itself internationally, at least in the immediate 6 months future, in a not simple situation. I'm very skeptical about almost each and every one of the steps that you just outlined. The ICC, the UN for the Palestinians, I actually see all of these acts as a fig leaf for a failed Palestinian leadership. You know, I think it's a way for Abbas to perpetuate his own power without elections and without legitimacy and try and show a heroic rebel face to his people that most of his people know is false but want to hope will work anyway. I don't see the Palestinian people in any way advancing thanks to any of these initiatives. I don't see a peace process advancing. And in a way, engaging in acts that are explicitly defiant of international norms makes the right-wing Israeli hand only stronger.
Right.
How many times have you heard Netanyahu say in the last few weeks and months, look at them with their unilateral steps? I mean, the Palestinian people and the Palestinian government have achieved exactly zero with these initiatives in terms of their own interests so far, and instead they gave what may have been his only strong argument, and they humiliated Tzipi Livni, who is a highly accomplished, intelligent, excellent, in my opinion, politician, who kind of put her career on the line for the peace process, and who was internationally humiliated by the Palestinian decision to turn to international organizations. And one of the things that we saw throughout this electoral campaign were people saying, well, you know, I could vote for Herzog, but then I'm going to be stuck with Livni. And that aversion to Livni, which had there was a certain, I think, aspect of sexism to it, but even more than that, there was an aspect of people seeing her as a kind of loser, as a kind of weight on the campaign. And the reason she was seen that way is, to a great extent, thanks to Mahmoud Abbas. And I think that's something that has to be said quite clearly.
I have quite a few family members who have a lot of disdain for her. Let's just say that's too.
Why? What's their disdain for her?
I think what you detailed. I mean, the fact that she's seen as this loser. Again, I don't necessarily agree with this, but you know, she jumps from party to party. She can't make a decision. I think in some ways she's seen as. And let's be clear, I think she's very similar to Netanyahu in that she's a survivor, you know, she's a political survivor. But I think that, I agree with you, I think there's a lot of sexism. There's a lot of really ugly rhetoric that I would hear from people. She's a political whore, you know, and that's not deliberate, you know, that is deliberate. That type of language that's used to describe her, she, you know, I had a relative who said, like, oh, I'm sure, like, now that she's in labor, she'll probably break up labor to sit with Bibi, you know, or she'll try to take over labor. I think that in the center, there's a lot of disdain and distrust that she'll just sort of, she has, the anti-Midas touch to some people.
Yeah, again, I think there's a lot of sexism there.
I agree.
I think that if you see male Israeli political leaders of her generation, I don't think there's a single one who has been in one party his whole life that has had a single name, including Bibi Netanyahu, maybe. He's the only one who might be an exception. But Olmert Sharon, I mean, who was a more macho man of Israeli politics, you know? So I dismiss that argument really as, even when I hear it from women, by the way, as really based in a lot of sexist disdain. But I think a real fact, a real thing that harmed her is that she was Israel's face to the peace process. She was the chief negotiator. She devoted this entire administration to try to achieve an agreement with the Palestinians, and she failed. And she failed in part because of, inconsistent Israeli policies. She failed because John Kerry didn't grasp the situation correctly, and she failed because the Palestinians turned on her. I don't know. I'm a little surprised that you compare her. You say she's similar to Netanyahu as a survivor. I think she's a very, very different political animal than him. And that's why we keep seeing him in that seat and her not.
I mean, I don't feel that she would do anything to stay in power. You know, I certainly don't think that she's ruthless.
Yeah.
And that she would jeopardize. Listen, I will say this, and some of our listeners may know this already, that I actually voted for her in 2013 because she was the only party that was talking about the peace process at the time, other than Meretz.
Did Meretz speak a lot of peace process?
In 2013, they did, but I think at the time there was, again, and I think the way the media framed the discussion about the 2013 elections, and again, like, don't underestimate the power that the media has, there really was a sense that the right wing is about to sweep into power. We're about to become a fascist state. There was really this, you know...
I don't think I've ever said this before. I've certainly never written this, but I think that the Israeli media at this point is failing its public, and I say that with an enormous amount of pain. I was very resistant throughout this campaign to all of the talk about the power of the media and that Yediot Ahronot was waging war against the prime minister and that Yediot somehow formed a moral equivalence to, you know, the free Adelson papers. I was very resistant to all of this kind of meta-political media talk throughout the campaign. And then we came to the last 3 days of this campaign, in which the prime minister permitted himself, as I said before, to give more interviews than he's given in his entire term in office, and he got softball questions almost universally. He permitted himself to openly and disdainfully boycott a TV station that he doesn't like. And no one said a word. Basically, no one said a word. And he was basically given, I would say, the last 3 or 4 days of the campaign, 24/7 free ad time for all of his bluster and all of his last-minute desperation. And those days of the campaign convinced me that there actually really is a problem in the Israeli media world. It was inappropriate. It was undemocratic. It was unprofessional to an extent that embarrasses me, and I probably shouldn't say any of this if I want to keep working, but that's how I feel. I think that there's a kind of internal accounting being done right now among many Israeli journalists that's sort of ideologically bent, you know, so you have the Raviv Drucker brand of journalists who are saying, so what that we're openly leftists, we're allowed to have opinions too, and that doesn't impact our work. You have right now the kind of victorious right-wing columnist saying, ha ha, we told you so, the people are with us, their hearts are with us, and you guys just live in your Tel Aviv bubble and don't get it. I think that a really important discussion is not yet being held, and that's a discussion of professionalism. And again, I want to give credit here to my colleague, Tal Schneider, who I collaborate with a lot. She and I have had a lot of discussions lately that basically come down to the Israeli media really has to remember what our role is and go back to, I think, our kind of origins, which is you're supposed to report the news. You're supposed to tell what's really happening. You're supposed to, you know, shoe leather. You're supposed to tramp through every city and every region and talk to people and get a real sense. And that's your job as a reporter. Your job is not to spout your opinions. I think that this is a distortion in part encouraged by social media, in part by a very small and very frenetic media market, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed.
So one last question for you for this.
Am I going to have any friends at the end of this interview?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, you'll have me, but I don't know if I don't really amount to much. So I wanted to, as a final question, I wanted to ask you about the United States' next steps in regards to, you know, action in the Security Council. We're hearing a lot of rumors now that the U.S. might actually go to the Security Council and table a resolution along, you know, along the Clinton parameters or Annapolis or whatever you want to call it. And I think that Netanyahu is sort of fretting a little bit. How realistic do you think this option is? You know, is there any real benefit to it? I mean, do you think that there will just be, you know, more blowback?
I think you're touching on one of the most delicate and one of the most complicated predicaments that Israel's finding itself in right now, because you're talking about three fronts coming together: the Israeli front, the American front, and the international front. The UN is, you know, the primary international organization. So it's very, very complex. I believe that the United States will act in its own interests in this respect. And I don't think that in terms of the United Nations, that the American interests deviate significantly from the Israeli interests. I don't think it's in the U.S. interest for resolution after resolution after resolution to be filed against Israel or to pass or not to be vetoed. My concern is a different concern. Netanyahu, in my opinion, and this I have argued publicly, has almost gone out of his way to show disdain and contempt for the President of the United States. I don't think that's a good idea for any leader. I specifically don't think that's a good idea for an Israeli leader when his state depends on a very deep and complex relationship with the United States, possibly for its survival. I think Netanyahu's defiance in this respect has been very unappealing and very harmful. So if I have to guess, I'll guess the two following things. I think that the United States government, under any president, will operate to defend American interests. And I think that the United States government, under President Obama, is going to act so as to basically keep Netanyahu out of the picture. And in this respect, we have to separate between Netanyahu and between the State of Israel. Despite his claims to represent all of the Jewish people, and despite his job as Prime Minister of Israel, and in that sense he does represent the people of the State of Israel, I think that the United States' solution is going to be to separate those two things. And so in terms of intelligence, in terms of military cooperation, in terms, you know, of a very, very, very difficult situation right now in the Middle East, in general, I think that the United States and Israel will continue to operate as they have. But I think that on the diplomatic level, in terms of the ability of Israel's ambassador to Washington to operate, and in terms of Netanyahu's personal access to the administration, I think we're going to see a very, very serious cooling down, and I think it's harmful. The last thing I want to say in this respect, and this is definitely editorializing, I think that Israel should be considering, I hope Israel's considering replacing its ambassador to Washington, D.C., who clearly did not act as a representative of the state, but acted as a campaigner for his prime minister in setting up this, you know, now notorious speech, which failed even in its number one aspect. You know, it failed in its stated aspect, which was to affect the possible Iran agreement. And it has clearly failed Israeli interests. And I think that his job should be on the line right now.
Noga Tarnopolsky, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.